It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to Ken Dreesen as part of our series of candidate interviews. He's the independent challenger for Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District seat. First, National Security Advisor John Bolton met with Russian leaders today, including President Vladimir Putin, to talk about a nuclear weapons treaty the country signed in the 1980s and about the Trump administration's plan to get out of that deal. The Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty banned the U.S. and what's now Russia from deploying certain ground-launched nuclear and conventional missiles. On Sunday, President Trump told reporters in Nevada why he wants the U.S. out of the deal.
Russia has violated the agreement. They've been violating it for many years, and I don't know why President Obama didn't negotiate or pull out. And we're not going to let them violate a nuclear agreement and go out and do weapons, and we're not allowed to. We're the ones that have stayed in the agreement, and we've honored the agreement, but Russia has not, unfortunately, honored the agreement. So we're going to terminate the agreement. We're going to pull out.
So what happens if the U.S. leaves the deal, and how might the two sides and other countries proceed? Alexandra Bell is the senior policy analyst at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. She focuses on national security issues in Congress, nuclear arms control, foreign policy, and other issues. Alexandra, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about this intermediate missile deal, just one part of the whole range of nuclear delivery devices. How important is this part of that?
Yes, the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty banned missiles with a range between 500 and 5,500 kilometers, so about 3,400 miles max. And it was created at a time where we had been deploying these missiles in Europe and Russia as well, creating a short warning nuclear attack threat for the entire continent. And it was really raising tensions of a possible nuclear war on the continent to such a level that there was incredible public backlash and a real drive for Presidents Reagan and Gorbachev to solve this problem. They met in Reykjavik, Iceland, in 1986, and as a result of that summit, they created the INF Treaty, which has been in force ever since.
Is the president right that Russia appears to be in violation of that treaty today?
Yeah, absolutely. Russia has been in violation of this treaty. The Obama administration announced that violation back in 2014, and we've been trying to get the Russians back into compliance ever since. It's been a slow process. The Russians have been sort of in a complete state of denial about the violation, and the nature of the violation has made it hard to talk about in public, which has sort of extended the process. Fortunately, there was a little bit of progress last December when the Trump administration used the name of the missile out loud in public. It's called the 9M729, and the Russians admitted that that missile existed. They still deny it violates the treaty, but now we're actually dealing in concrete terms, and that was something that we could build a diplomatic effort around. And unfortunately, the Trump administration has not taken that opportunity, nor has Russia, to fix this treaty that really does present a threat to both countries, as well as the continent of Europe.
It seems like the U.S. would have two options, given this violation, to negotiate within the terms of this treaty, or, as we're seeing now, to leave that treaty and, I guess, hope that motivates more serious action. What do you think of those two approaches?
I think it's a bit of a gamble to threaten to leave a treaty that I think the Russians may have some interest in getting out of, but have been loath to sort of take the hit of doing it themselves. They feel like perhaps they need this missile because China and other neighboring countries have the ability to build this missile. The U.S. doesn't need this missile at all, and we have lots of capabilities that can, you know, protect our allies and the homeland. So you really wanted Russia at the table, and we have not exhausted all our diplomatic options, and that's what's really disappointing here. I'm hard-pressed to find an instance of President Trump ever actually saying the full treaty name out loud, and it doesn't seem like this has really risen to his level until the sidelines of a political rally. And that's not really the way to get out of a 31-year-old, really pivotal Cold War treaty and a legacy of President Reagan.
I was playing around with online maps. It seems like deploying these in Russia, you could threaten, for the United States, you could threaten Alaska, the West Coast, but you could really cover all of China or all of Europe. Is that the big worry, looking at China and Europe and the potential for Russia to use this, not necessarily even use it, but to use it as a threat?
I think the concern is more in Europe. The Russian Federation has lots of intercontinental ballistic missiles to threaten the United States with, so these intermediate-range missiles are really more about Russia's neighbors. And because they have a short warning attack time, about 15 minutes between launch and strike, it reduces the reaction time available. You really are trying to extend the amount of time in between a possible launch and reaction. It's destabilizing to have these short order attacks, and we actually already went through this process once in the 1980s. We know where this process leads. It's incredibly dangerous. The need to repeat it now is very baffling.
Talking to Alexandra Bell from the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation about the Trump administration plan to withdraw from this intermediate range missile treaty with the then Soviet Union, now with Russia and other former Soviet republics. Alexandra, another concern raised about this deal is it includes the U.S. and Russia and now some of the descendant states from the Soviet Union. It doesn't include countries, as I understand it, like China. How big a problem is that?
It does not include China, and was never intended at the time to include China. We are worried about Chinese intermediate-range forces. It does make up the bulk of their strategic forces, but we haven't really had a conversation with them. First, at the very basic level, just for transparency purposes, understanding how China thinks about the use of these missiles and what these missiles are for from Beijing's perspective, that's the first step to getting into a situation where we can deal with the Chinese threat. But the worst thing that we can do is sort of create problems for us both in the European theater and the Asian theater at the same time. We need to fix the INF treaty, and there is still time to do it, and then deal with the China problem. But of course, I make it clear that our own military leaders have made it quite clear to our Congress that we have plenty of assets, both air and sea launch, to protect our vital interest in Asia. We don't need ground launch cruise missiles there, which is the type of missile banned by the treaty.
When we look at issues like trade, the Trump administration has in some cases threatened to leave trade agreements, maybe as a bargaining chip. Is there an analogy here? Could it be that threatening to take our ball and go home motivates other parties, the Russians in this case, to negotiate more seriously?
I think it's a serious gamble, and I think it's unnecessary. The full weight of the White House, joined by our allies in Europe, can be a lot of pressure to bring Russia back to the table. That said, this seems to be the president's preferred operating procedure. So hopefully, if that is the gamble here, that they are prepared and willing to go back to the negotiating table with the technical experts that we have throughout the government and really figure out how to solve this problem.
Big picture, Alexandra. I mean, I was around in the 80s, nuclear weapons of the U.S. and the Soviet Union. It was a big worry, I think, from day to day, and arms negotiations were front page news. Those things aren't really true today. We don't pay as much attention, should we?
Unfortunately, we don't. I think at the end of the Cold War, people were relieved to get out of what they thought was sort of the constant threat of nuclear war. And they sort of just said, oh, great, that's done. And they moved on to other issues. And there are a lot of other pressing security issues around the world, but none so existential as the threat the nuclear weapons pose. There's still 17,000 plus nuclear weapons around the world and enough material to make tens of thousands more. It is an issue that people need to be paying attention to. The U.S. itself is about to embark or in the process of fully modernizing its nuclear arsenal at the cost of estimated for inflation $1.7 trillion over the next 30 years. The American public will buy this arsenal with their hard-earned tax dollars. They should be participating in the conversation of what we're doing with it.
And finally, as you mentioned, these weapons are mostly of concern if Russians have them for our European allies. Do you see consultation going on between the Trump administration and those allies when it comes to an issue like this intermediate weapons treaty?
I was very concerned, actually, that the president was asked a question about whether or not we had consulted allies about this particular move to potentially withdraw from the treaty, and he responded that he didn't have to talk to them. That's the absolute wrong approach to take. our allies are vital for our own protection. This alliance that we've built has created, you know, this incredible military force. Things that we do to undermine our European allies, to undermine NATO, are only going to hurt us in the end. We need to have their help and support. And quite frankly, if we want to fix this treaty, we need them to be leaning on President Putin just as hard as we're leaning on him.
Alexandra, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Alexandra Bell is the Senior Policy Director at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. We talked with her about the Trump administration's plan to exit the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty with Russia. First, between now and the November 6th general election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested races for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You'll be able to find all of those interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today we talked to Ken Dreesen. He's an independent candidate running for Wisconsin's 7th congressional district seat, which serves northern Wisconsin. Also in that race, incumbent Republican Sean Duffy and Democratic candidate Margaret Engebretson. Ken Dreesen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Well, what do you think is the most important issue facing your potential constituents in Wisconsin's 7th congressional district?
Well, our issues are the same as they are for the people of this nation for the most part. I think from what I found on the surveys is that health care is right up, and corruption and money in politics is right up there, and endless wars, nobody likes that, and probably fourth on the list is immigration, and I think that might not be that big of a problem, but President Trump has brought that up to the foreground.
And you are running on a kind of a unique platform of direct participatory democracy. What does that mean? How would you implement that as a member of Congress?
Well, first of all, one big thing that we do in Wisconsin is the Wisconsin Elections Commission has all of our information, the information of every voter online. So a person can go to myvote.gov.wi and find their where they're registered, and I could use this information to make a secure, honest vote. And anybody that was interested in voting on law and appropriation rather than just on a person could do that through my website and through open source software. And I think it's important because right now we're controlled by the majority of the money rather than the majority of the people. And so I think a system like that is bound to happen because both a democracy and a constitutional republic depend on the majority.
So would you try that in your district if you were elected? You'd, on a particular vote, you might say, okay, voters of the 7th District, go to the website, weigh in on this, and that would shape your ultimate decision?
Yeah, I promised to do that, to vote in the interest of the majority, no matter even if it's something that I would disagree with, because I think it's so important that even if I was flooded by real conservative votes, I would honor their vote, and whoever participates would have my vote. And it's kind of a radical idea, and especially now with the president calling democracy mob rule. But that's ridiculous because, like I said, a democracy and a republic depends on the majority mandate. And actually, in my studies, the majority are more progressive than conservative on most issues. If you make the questions right, most people do want some kind of a governmental universal Medicaid, Medicare for All program. And a lot of the other issues are a little more progressive. It's just like if you take Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton, both of them, in my point of view, were recognized as kind of like, I don't know, for the elite and kind of greedy and kind of untrustworthy. So then that was a tough election. But even under that, Hillary would definitely be a little more progressive than Trump, and the majority voted for Hillary.
And before we get into particular issues, if you're elected as an independent, would you see yourself caucusing with one party over the other? How would you handle that?
Well, I guess the way that it works, I would probably be caucusing more so with the Democrats, or I would just, if I did that on my own, then I would put it up on the website and I would put all the issues before the people. Like, hey, who do you want me to caucus with? And then there's what kind of bills do we want to sign on to? And then I would make it open source of how much money comes out of the district, how much money comes into the district, and what different projects do we want to invest in? Did we want in our district, of course, we didn't, but did we want a $4 billion given to a foreign company to bring a business over here from the Asia? Or I don't know. Well, I think it's so important that the majority has a say that I'm willing to go, even if it's against my more progressive, more of a Bernie Sanders kind of outlook on life.
Talking to Ken Dreesen, independent candidate running for Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. That's in northern Wisconsin. Now, I know you might send these issues to the voters, but I want to get your take on a few of the issues that you've brought up as important in your district. And let's start with health care, a big issue in this election. What kind of health care policy do you think Congress should be looking at and considering?
Well, just like my Democratic opponent in this, we both agree that there should be some sort of Medicaid or Medicare for all program to eliminate the private insurance industry, which I just looked up some of the companies. I think it was maybe Humana, and I think there's United, and some of their CEOs make tens of millions and even $100 million a year. How many doctors could that have provided? How many other things that are necessary for good health of our country that are going into the insurance? So I think we can get a system like that going if, like some of these tax cuts that are going mainly to the billionaires, if they kind of got rid of that. And when I was working full-time in the industry, I think it was like something like 7.5% deductions came out of your paycheck in order to pay for your Social Security and other deductions that you had. And if we could raise that up a few percentage, then you're not going to have to pay private health care insurance. So you will save money. Even the Koch brothers did a study that said some kind of universal national health care will save money. But both sides don't really see it that way.
You also mentioned that your constituents or potential constituents raise the issue of corruption and money in politics. What kind of reforms would you want to look at?
Well, I'm starting out and I'm not raising any money. I spent probably still less than $1,000 of my own money. And I write a lot of letters to newspapers and things like that. And I would hope that maybe we could get some kind of public funding and something so that public service on commercial television radio stations would make it so that we can have more debates and we can have more writings of people running for office and inform the public and make it a fair system. Because I'm up against a guy that has about $2 million, and I research where the money comes from, and it's mostly all corporations and mostly all out of state. So we can write some legislation to change that around, and I think the majority of people are for it, because even the Democrats, Republicans, anybody, no matter what side they fall on, they all agree that the government is crooked. It's something like up to 92% of people surveyed, anywhere from 65 to 92% of the people surveyed say that there's corruption and too much money in politics.
Immigration ends up being a big issue around election time every couple of years, it seems like. But it's been an eternal issue in Congress. Efforts to change the system, nothing really happening. What would you look for on that immigration issue?
Well, I would ask the people to think about why foreigners want to come here and what is happening in their country. Because, like, the Iraq war, most people believe that there was no weapons of mass destruction, and we know that they had nothing to do with the 911, and we went over there and killed 500,000 to 1 million people, and that's terrible. And some people there worked on our side. They're providing information and working with our soldiers, and they're saying that they can't come here. That's pretty nasty. And then the same thing in South America. There's, like, the drug wars, and then corporations coming in there and whatever, buying up all the resources and making it impossible for people to earn an honest living without being connected to this corporate money. And income inequality in these countries is worse than us. So they want to make the United States into what they're making the rest of the world. They want to make us into a third world. And I think even if people think about it on both sides of the spectrum, even conservatives, they're going to have to go with, instead of being conservative versus liberal, they're going to have to go with right versus wrong.
Kendreason, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Activist and former union steward Kendreason is an independent candidate in Wisconsin's 7th congressional district race in northern Wisconsin. Incumbent Congressman Sean Duffy, the Republican incumbent in that race, is tentatively scheduled to join us this time Thursday. Between now and the November 6th general election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested races for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and the Morning Show. You can find all of these interviews and learn more about the candidates and races at wisconsinvote.org. First, so you want to be the president of the United States? You're not alone. A lot of people have grown up with that dream over the years. It's a high-profile job. You'll go down in the history books, and you'll have a lot of power to shape the future of the country. But hold on. With great power comes great responsibility to the people, to the country, and to the Constitution. There's debate out there over the provisions of the Constitution and how they limit the powers of the president. Our next guest has written a user's guide to the Constitution for future presidents of the United States, and for the rest of us, too. Corey Brettschneider is a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, also a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. His new book is The Oath and the Office, a guide to the Constitution for future presidents. Corey, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, that's a very specific target audience. What made you want to write this guide? I know it's for the rest of us, too, but what made you want to write this constitutional guide for the hypothetical future president out there?
I've been teaching these topics in constitutional law, for instance, what was the dry topic of whether the president can hire and fire prosecutors, for instance, or special prosecutors for a long time. And then when Trump started to run and to make a series of proposals that were really different than any previous candidate in their lack of knowledge, I'd say, of the Constitution and its hostility, I started to think about a guide to originally Trump's violations of the Constitution. And then I thought, you know, what the country really needs is not a focus just on this moment, but a reflection on what it takes to be president of the United States, and a look at Article 2, which defines the office of president in constitutional terms, in terms of its limits. And it's really a guide not just, of course, for future presidents, but for the rest of us, for citizens, and how to vote for a president. And I want the next presidential election to be a referendum on the Constitution and the role of the president within that system.
The tricky bit, or one of the tricky bits, is, you know, the Constitution's a pretty short document. People have been reading it in some ways in different ways when it comes to the president, going back at least to John Adams, the second president, if not even to George Washington. There are different interpretations, ways of reading it, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I am with Washington, I guess, and against Adams in the book in this sense. Washington's second inaugural address really sets the theme and the thesis of the book. He says there, look, I've just taken the oath of office. But if I violate the Constitution, the oath requires me to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. But if I violate it, I want you, the people assembled before us, and he had just a few members of Congress. It was a very small gathering in Philadelphia. And he said, I want the people assembled here to subject me to criticism and subject me to constitutional punishment. Because me, George Washington, I am not the office. The office is in some sense distinct and above me. And so I use that as sort of a message to the rest of us to hold a president who violates the Constitution to account. On Adams, he was really, I think, although he thought he was acting within the constitutional system, he really had something much closer to the monarchy in mind, and in particular, his support of the Alien and Sedition Acts, which made it a crime to criticize the president of the United States, but made it legal to criticize the vice president, a member of a different party, Thomas Jefferson. That was really an example of a president who had gone astray in the worst possible way. So I'd say certainly there have been different interpretations. I'm trying to give the best one, and I'm with Washington and against Adams and his regime of censorship. I think that's a good leg to stand on.
Well, fast forward to 2018 now. Looking back at Article 2, what do you see as the most important limits on the power of a modern president that we should be learning when we reread the Constitution?
One thing I talk about is the war power. The Constitution is very clear, and here I don't think scholars really disagree, although presidents disagree. It's Congress that has the power to initiate war and declare war is the language that's used, and the president that's commander-in-chief. So I think we need a new War Powers Act to demand, for instance, that the first strike of nuclear weapons only be ordered by Congress, not by president. I think we also need to fix sometimes the framers really relied on a president that would honor the Constitution. And another place I think that we need to fix is to defend independent the special prosecutor from being fired without cause. We need to go back to the old independent counsel rule. So those are two examples, I think, of where we've gone astray.
Let's key in on that War Powers Act before we move on too far from it, because this is not just a Donald Trump issue. A lot of presidents have been stretching that, people have said, and saying, well, yes, there are troops here. They're in harm's way. It's not a war, though, so I can do this as president.
Right. And I'm very critical, for instance, of President Obama's use of drones in Libya, where, you know, even members of his own Office of Legal Counsel said, you know, this is a to initiate war in Libya specifically, you need Congress. And President Obama didn't listen to them. And I think that's just an example where presidents of both parties certainly can go astray. This isn't just a book about Trump. It's also critical of many Democratic presidents as well.
Talking to Corey Brettschneider, author of The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. And Corey, you write not just about what presidents do, but also about what they say, how they use what came to be called the bully pulpit under Theodore Roosevelt. What should that hypothetical future president bear in mind?
You know, there isn't a lot of court restrictions on what a president can say, but certainly the bully pulpit is one of the most powerful things that a president does. And it was invented by Roosevelt and really turned into a constitutional ideal by Wilson and then expanded again by Trump. In this sense, Wilson really had to rely on the press, right, to get his message across and turn to lobby Congress to pass legislation he wanted. Trump has really revolutionized the bully pulpit because he can speak directly to us through Twitter and possibly through our cell phones, and the press is sort of an afterthought. But with that great power, I think, has to come even more recognition of the limits of the office. And the language of the bully pulpit has to be used to not just not violate the Constitution, not just not speak against it, but to defend it. And Wilson and Trump also have this in common. They both, in their racist rhetoric, in their disparagement, in Trump's example, for instance, saying that there are good people on both sides of in the Charlottesville dispute between Nazis and anti-Nazis. That is like Wilson and his celebration of the Ku Klux Klan. And I think we need to see this as a violation of the Constitution because presidents are being elected to defend the ideals of the Constitution, including equal protection of law, anti-racism. And so these two examples are really of presidents gone astray.
You mentioned the hiring and firing of a special prosecutor, but you write more generally about the president and his or her administration's ability to fire civil servants. That's an open debate under the Trump administration. It's got a long history in the United States. Can you talk us through how we got where we are today?
Sure. Wilson, again, I think in some ways is the bad guy in this, in that he really didn't like the idea that many executive offices were protected by Congress. And the reason for that historically has been, going back to the 19th century, that Congress has legislation, and part of the job of the executive branch is to carry out that legislation. And so by protecting civil servants and members of the executive branch from firing without cause or without disregard of their basic duties, that's a way of Congress ensuring that the law will be executed and that a president won't act as a lawmaker. But many presidents have attacked that. Wilson is one, and certainly Trump is another and has made that very prominent. And I really call for a restoration of the idea that was recognized really since the 1930s and earlier, that Congress can make laws protecting protecting civil servants with an aim to carrying out the law. And that's nowhere is that more important than when it comes to those who are investigating wrongdoing of a president. If a president isn't above the law, it stands to reason that a special prosecutor has to be able to bring charges and can't be fired because a president wants to protect him or herself. The idea of the oath is that a president has to act for others, not for oneself. And so this is an important place where that informs the need for protection of civil servants and certainly a special prosecutor, an independent prosecutor.
Yeah, and you focus on the oath of the office. What does the president pledge to do when it comes to the Constitution when they take office?
I mean, really, if you look in Article 2, the first few seconds in office are prescribed. The president not only has to take an oath, they're very specific words. When Obama flubbed it at one point, they did it a second time. They take it that seriously. But I think many people hear the oath and they sort of think of it as a ritual. But the actual promise, the oath, is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, not just the country, but to recognize the rule of law and to go beyond the minimum of what's required to really interpret it for oneself. So that idea of Article 2 stands for the notion of limits on the president and a president's obligation to respect the Constitution, even when, and this is crucial for me, courts don't require it. So maybe courts have not said, for instance, that a president can't torture, but I say that certainly it is incumbent on presidents to recognize that the Eighth Amendment's tradition against monarchy and against unusual punishments like ear chopping restrain a president as well because of the oath.
Talking to Corey Brettschneider right now, professor of political science at Brown University. He's the author of The Oath and the Office, a guide to the Constitution for future presidents. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the Constitution as it applies to the powers of a president and the limits of those powers? What constitutional questions do you think the president should have to consider before they take office? Do you think the Constitution goes far enough in providing a check on the executive branch? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the presidency and the U.S. Constitution. Our guest is Corey Brettschneider, author of The Oath and the Office, a guide to the Constitution for future presidents. You can join in at 800-642-1234, whether you're a future president or not. What do you think a president should know about the Constitution before they take office? Do you think that the president should have to study that Constitution before they get into office? Do you think the modern American presidency is too powerful, not powerful enough? Do you have questions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Corey, a lot of your book is about the need to take the Constitution seriously for a president, but you also say, you know, it's not a sacred document in some ways. It was written by flawed people in some cases. There were flaws in the original Constitution. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, certainly the original Constitution, which preserved the slave trade, for one thing, for several years, they weren't even allowed to talk about it, and protected slavery, for instance, in the census counting enslaved people as less than a full person. Those were deep flaws. But what I say in the book is that over time, through amendments, partly the Equal Protection Clause that's been improved upon, and that also I don't think that the framers thought of themselves as perfect. They laid down some very broad provisions, including equal protection of law, no cruel and unusual punishment, due process, that open up a sense of values and a discussion for not just future presidents, future courts, future citizens, to consider the real meaning and to correct the framers when they were wrong. And certainly on the slavery issue, on segregation, they were deeply wrong. And so I'm critical in the book of views like Justice Scalia's, which have an overly narrow way of reading the text. Now, these sound like very abstract law school debates, but in the book, I just do it through stories. And I tell the story, for instance, of Joe Biden, a young senator at the time, confronting Justice Bork, an early defender of Scalia's view of constitutional interpretation, and really laying out this specific idea that, you know, it's a set of values that all of us have to engage in a conversation about. And that's part of what I'm trying to do in this very conversational style. It's somebody said it's like a dad leaning in to talk to his daughter. The book's dedicated to my daughter. And it's got that style to try to get us to reflect on not just the text, not just the cases, which I talk about and tell the stories of, but also the deep values of the Constitution.
Let's go to a caller now. Ray is with us in Eau Claire. Ray, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Ray?
Well, first of all, the speaker had some really good information, I thought. I read the Constitution again yesterday, and I was impressed with, A, that it's a relatively short document, B, that it leaves a certain amount of interpretation available, so if we need to make a change, we can. But I was concerned about the fact, I've been concerned over how little authority anyone has over the current president, and I see that that's right out of the Constitution, too. And I think it's John Adams, because he was trying to recreate Britain's system perfectly, and he did, including the king.
Yes, I mean, I take that up in the book, and I talk about the Adams tradition of thinking about presidents as in some ways beyond the other branches, maybe even above the law. Adams at one point considered bringing back royal titles, and he had a vision of the presidency that was much closer to monarchy. But my argument in the book is that we really, in the structure of the Constitution, reject that idea. The oath itself is about not profiting from office, serving the Constitution, the Emoluments Clause. And then I say in the book, controversially, that although there's a live debate, for instance, about whether a sitting president is immune from criminal indictment, for instance, in the Mueller investigation, that the framers disagreed. Hamilton thought, yes, a president was immune, but James Wilson of Pennsylvania said, the president is not above the law. And that's an idea that we see also in the Nixon case about U.S. v. Nixon, a unanimous case about the president's need to answer a subpoena. And the idea is very simple there. 8-0, a president is not above the law. And so I use that case, this history, to try to make the argument that actually even President Trump, any sitting president, is not above the law and actually can be subject to indictment. So I think the Constitution allows us to stop a president and to enforce the rule of law.
Ray, thanks for the call. Going out to Jeff in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hello, gentlemen. My question is regarding life. The Constitution must have some kind of way of determining when life begins. In other words, if you're born in the United States, does that mean your life begins at birth? You know, specifically with regarding the laws regarding abortion, and also with regard to eligibility for the presidency, only a natural-born citizen can become president. So how did, in 2018, how would life be defined as beginning, or when does life begin, and also what defines a natural-born citizen?
It's a great question. Roe versus Wade says the following thing. It not only provides a right of privacy that includes a woman's right to an abortion, but it also says that the fetus might be a person theologically. But as far as the Constitution is concerned, if a fetus was recognized as a person, that would mean that we couldn't have state-by-state decisions. We'd need a national ban on abortion. And the position of Roe, one of its most important holdings, is the idea that a fetus is not a constitutional person, and that's why there is a right to an abortion. Now, that's a complicated idea that justices like Gorsuch challenge. And one of the radical things about this justice, I think, as opposed to the one that I would choose, is that I think he actually is toying in his academic writing with the idea of a right of life of the fetus recognized by the court and nationally protected. So we're in a point of transition. We're arguing there are multiple interpretations of the Constitution. I don't hold Justice Gorsuch's view, but what you've asked, caller, really opens up the kind of dilemmas that I'm trying to look at seriously in this book.
Jeff, thanks for that call. We're talking to Corey Brettschneider. His new book is The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. The last portion of your book, Corey, is all about how to stop a president who doesn't follow those rules. So in 2018, looking back at the Constitution, what kind of tools are there to stop a president who doesn't honor these restrictions?
Controversially, I talk, as I said before, about the right of a prosecutor to indict a sitting president. Presidents like Clinton resisted that in Clinton v. Jones and in a series of memos. But I say, if you take seriously the idea that I started with, that Washington gave us, which is that the president is not the office, that there has to be a way of protecting the office from a president who goes astray. So indictment is one strong way that I argue for. Another less familiar way is, I go back to that Adams story. John Adams, as I said, signed the Alien Sedition Acts, making it a crime to criticize him. The sitting vice president, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison, the primary architect of our constitutional system, went back home to Virginia, and they passed two resolutions, the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, that said, we're not going to cooperate with the federal government when it comes to unconstitutional policy. And my argument in the book is that cities like Santa Clara, and I profile the COO of Santa Clara County, Miguel Marquez, who are trying to use the 10th Amendment, the right of the states to resist unconstitutional executive orders, federal demands, that they are, while recognizing that the federal law is supreme, they're using the mechanisms of the states to say, we don't have to cooperate with ICE. Local police forces don't work for the president of the United States, and they can resist a president constitutionally when it comes to unconstitutional executive orders. So that's a second place, the role of the states. And the final, of course, is impeachment, the strongest remedy here. And there the hero is Frederick Douglass, I say, who said about the first President Johnson that when it comes to a openly racist president who repeatedly speaks against the basic rights of African Americans and who refuses to enforce the ban on slavery, let's just be honest and say this is why we're going to impeach him. Let's not have a legalistic argument about other matters. And I say, you know, that's really what impeachment is about. It's about the oath itself, a willingness to protect the Constitution, to respect the rule of law. And if it comes down to it, if there is a national debate about impeachment, we need to be honest about Frederick Douglass's recognition that this is a political process. There is no high crime in criminal law. This is a political standard that brings us right back to the title of the book, both the oath and the office. And I also take from a Republican member of Congress during the Nixon administration the following quote. He said, look, I'm voting for these articles of impeachment in the House Judiciary Committee because I want what we're doing now to be a guide to the Constitution for future presidents. And that Republican utterance at that time helped to bring down Nixon, and I use that in the book as the subtitle and also as a theme of the last chapter.
In our last minute or so, Corey, there were two, it seems like, overarching themes, the worry that a president would be a new king of England, or a worry that a demagogue would rise in the sort of the ancient Greek or Roman sense to motivate the masses to overthrow democracy. In our last minute, is the Constitution proof against that happening?
Donald Trump, I think, has created a stress test on the Constitution. It has many provisions which are honorable, including the oath itself, the First Amendment protection of free speech. But when you have a president repeatedly railing against those basic values, who, if he's read it, is hostile to it, for instance, in his attacks on the press, which is protected under our First Amendment, and his defense of the idea that the families of suspected terrorists should be tortured, violation, obviously, of our due process clause and our Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishment, that is the kind of thing the framers were worried about. They had somebody like George Washington in mind who presided over the Constitution, somebody who had respect for the rule of law, respect for the citizenry. And, you know, yes, we are now faced with somebody who is exactly the opposite of that and what they feared. And this is a test on whether or not they prepared us for it. They gave us many mechanisms to resist such a person that I talked about. But will it hold? I don't know. That's, in the end, why I wrote the book. It's up to all of us to, in the next election, the midterms, and in the next presidential election, to defend the Constitution. Because,
and we'll leave it there. Thanks to Corey Brettschneider. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. When junk food news happens, it happens fast. And when it happens, producer Chris Molina is there. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Rob.
So we've got some, and now you're a big fan of a certain sandwich-style cookie on the market.
You are correct. I am a fan of the Oreo.
The Oreo. And we've got the regular, there's flavors, there's the double stuff Oreo, but now there's something new coming out.
So Oreo is going to be apparently coming out next year with like a word cramming more stuff, and that is the official term for the filling in the Oreo is stuff with one F.
Right. Yeah, one F, because they didn't meet the FDA requirements for actual stuff.
Exactly, yeah, you know, so half of it, so only one F. So
they're like coming, cheese with a Z.
Exactly, yeah. So they're coming out with this new Oreo, which is going to have more stuff than ever before. And I don't know how I feel about this, because I think a lot of people really like the stuff. But, you know, like, the double stuff is kind of like the perfect mix of the cream, of the wafers. It's kind of like, you know, when you're, like, driving by Culver's or your other favorite frozen custard place, and you see on the sign that the flavor of the day is, like, the triple chocolate, brownie, caramel, salted, dark chocolate, whatever. It's too much. You know, you just want...
I disagree.
Okay, well, we're going to have words after this is over. So I think you know, double stuff is just fine. Am I going to try the one that has the mountain of stuff on it? Absolutely.
Of course we are. Yeah, I worry when they king-size those treats, the ratio goes off. The chocolate to the filling, it can just be off and it'll be all wrong, is what I worry about.
It's true. And then it only sets the bar higher for, like, in 2022 when, like, the extra mega super double stuff comes out.
Right. And somebody bought some double stuffs today and somebody ate too many. Those somebodies were both me.
Two people.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.